ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। So we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 7, chapter entitled The Killing of the Demon Trinavarta, text number 30. Pradaya matre pratihetya vismita Krishnam chatasyo rasilambamanam tam swastimantam purushadanitam vihayasa mrityu mukhat pramuktam Gopyascha gopa kila nanda mukhya labdhva punah prapur ativa modam Translation: The gopis immediately picked Krishna up from the chest of the demon and delivered him, free from all inauspiciousness, to Mother Yashoda. Because the child, although taken into the sky by the demon, was unhurt and now free from all danger and misfortune, the gopis and cowherd men, headed by Nanda Maharaj, were extremely happy. Purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. The demon fell flat from the sky, and Krishna was playing on his chest very happily, uninjured and free from misfortune. Not at all disturbed because of being taken high in the sky by the demon, Krishna was playing and enjoying. This is Ananda Chinmaya Rasa Vigraha. In any condition, Krishna is Sachidananda Vigraha. He has no unhappiness. Others might have thought that he was in difficulty, but because the demon's chest was sufficiently broad to play on, the baby was happy in all respects. It was most astonishing that although the demon went so high in the sky, the child did not fall down. Therefore, the child had been saved virtually from the mouth of death. Now that he was saved, all the inhabitants of Vrindavan were happy. So in all these continuing wonderful pastimes of the Lord, in this pastime we are, in this chapter we are seeing the wonderful pastime of the killing of Trinavarta. So a question may arise that ultimately these pastimes are also quite violent, and therefore we also see violence in the world around us. So there may not be something wrong. Why should there be? Because Krishna is violent and everything comes from him, so we are also violent, so it should be all right. It is true that today's world, there is so much of violence around us, and this is Kali Yuga. As Kali Yuga progresses, without any causes really, the urge to take violent acts happens more and more. At least in the previous yugas, there would be some standards, there would be an etiquette, and there were also people who were true to their own ashrams and varnas. So therefore, those who were in the kshatriya mold, for protection of honor, they had to resort to acts of violence, but it was also done under rules. But the sign of times today is that this violence is not born out of any code or etiquette or any rules. It is basically born out of our uncontrolled senses and our urge to go after lust, anger and greed. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that the three gates to hell are lust, anger and greed. And any sane man must try to get rid of them. Otherwise they will lead to degradation of the soul. So this, in today's world, what we see is an increasing trend. Why we are talking of a Kali Yuga which is only 5,000 years old and going on for another 435,000 years, 430,000 years. So we would say that we are only in the beginning, but we can already see that even in our own lifetimes, those of us who are now in their 50s or 60s can actually see a difference between in 30 years, what a transformation there is. And we think this is the worst, but it can get even much worse. Every field of activity we see is covered with violence. Even so-called entertainment or sports, which are supposed to be, they used to call sports a gentleman's game. The word gentle has undergone a transformation. There's so much intense competitiveness. Why? Because there is a urge for greed, for power, for money. There's intense competition for getting your favorite team or favorite person to win. And they do anything to protect that. And people support that. People actually, the mood of the people, and it's not just in India, it's all over. The mood of the people is also to, they hanker for this. They get excited. It really brings greater and greater excitement. And because it brings excitement, then naturally it is a paying proposition. So you see hoardings also supporting that. Even in cinemas, we see the hoardings we see outside. I mean, we don't need to elaborate on that, but we can. This is one of the most basic things that we see. That we see even innocent-looking young girls or children also holding knives and very gory-looking scenes, all blood spattered. So why would they put it? Ultimately, it's only a reflection of what the people's desires are, which means the people want to see this and people are willing to pay for it. So that brings the excitement to a level which they would want to continue. And this happens from childhood. We see even cartoons and things also gradually becoming more and more violent. And even children would generally prefer to hear stories of Mahabharata, even among devotees, children. We would hope that they grow out of it, but that is the nature, that the interest is always, somebody beating the other person up. And violence and lust are two things which is a very potent or palatable combination for the Kali Yuga. And there is a deep desire to go after something, that means you have a deep attachment to something, you lust for it, whether it is for the opposite sex or whether it is for other objects or senses. And for achieving that, you are actually heroized. It means you become a hero if you are able to achieve. People consider you a hero even if you use any means. So today the means justify the ends. I mean, anything can go as long as you can be successful. And actually, we read in the scriptures, we are always constantly told that the soul, the pure soul, is actually attracted to Krishna. But in this material world, the whole there is a complete transformation that takes place. Why? Because of the attachment to the bodily senses. And if there's any proof of the scriptures' potency, if there's one single example or shlok or which can capture this, it's really the way Bhagavad Gita explains how the whole system of fall down takes place. Because we actually experience this, and it's amazing how true it is and written. Of course, it's spoken by Krishna himself, but when he explains that how first the attachment to the sense objects begins, and as the attachment becomes stronger, the attraction becomes stronger, then lust develops, that we want it. And when that lust is unfulfilled, then anger erupts. Because we're not able to get everything. We're never going to get everything. So then, and when that anger increases, then memory gets bewildered. And when memory becomes bewildered, then intelligence is lost. Intelligence is lost, then we fall down in the material pool, which means we fall into these sinful activities. And this is something which, if any objective person analyzes himself or herself, will actually see. After hearing about the scriptures, and then he wants to test it, This is one of the most potent and also most important reasons to believe the value of the scriptures, that it actually lays down the chart how we are going to just absolutely crash down. This is it's so perfectly laid down, and it goes sequentially. And actually, we at different times may have lost at our senses, or we have experienced this, and we see that it's true, that this is what actually happens. And when we lose control, so therefore a sane man is one, as Krishna says, someone who tries to get rid of these and goes to the root and tries to get rid of these desires for greed, for lust, for anger. Because no matter what people may say, no matter how the world environment is, but if we succumb to it, then it's a one-way path to destruction, and it can be very, very swift. It may take us years to develop interest in Krishna conscious activities or Krishna conscious Krishna katha, but it can take moments, not even days. It could be moments before we can do crazy things. And uncontrolled anger, people can do anything. Even good people can do crazy things. It's a terrible phenomenon. And when we see certain symptoms of that all over the world, we read in the papers and we hear about it, we experience it in our neighborhood or in our families, we can actually see how this develops and how it can take control over us, and we lose control over everything else. And Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami has given a very nice, very simple explanation about the two extremes of and the difference between love and lust, that is prem and kaam. That means because he says that he gives the example of the iron and gold, that both are metal. So there in one sense they are the same superficially, but the value of iron is nothing. It's just a base metal. But gold is so precious. So basically, if we are attracted or doing activities linking it to Krishna in some form or the other, directly or indirectly, then that develops prem. And the as much as we go away from Krishna, then to that extent it develops kaam or lust. Because that's where the envy of Krishna comes. We may not actually think in that way directly, but actually that is the symptom. And before we know it, we would be wanting to lord it over, and we don't see the presence of Krishna as necessary. Of course, we also have examples of transcendental anger. When we talk of uncontrolled anger, there is also anger in the spiritual, or at least not, I would say, in the spiritual, anger in by spiritual personalities or pure devotees. Lord Hanumanji is there, and Arjun. I mean, we see that, but that is always in the service of Krishna. So if there's the difference is always that when it is purely for the service of the Lord, it's in a different category. So one cannot judge only by just the final act. Like that way, Kurukshetra, there was so much violence. But why do we say in Kurukshetra that, how do we justify it? Because it was when it was in defense of protection of the good, it was an annihilation of the miscreants, that actually Krishna let it happen. And in Krishna's violence, so-called violence, actually not acts of violence. When Krishna exhibits anger, it's not so. Why? Because whoever takes part, or whoever is actually affected by it, let's say in Kurukshetra millions of people died, all of them went back to Godhead. How can there be violence? So actually he is our ever well-wisher, and he is so kind, he is so merciful, that even those who are envious of him, those who were in his presence were also given the chance to go back to Godhead, which is quite difficult to understand unless we actually see it from the eyes of the scriptures. Yeah, and in today, people are also so proud of their of the angry acts. That means they are totally unrepentant. See, when we don't want to listen to any guidance or any authority, then there is one symptom where so it may be that a budding devotee, someone who is taking to Krishna consciousness. We are not pure devotees, so we will always on and off succumb to our weaknesses. But there is the feeling of guilt, there is our conscience which tells us that we have to take control of our own lives and make amends, try to avoid rectifying it. But here we see it is more an act of actual glorification. There is a mood of unrepentance that we can, actually this is what is justified. I remember reading about it many years ago. A simple thing, like even in sports, there was this one sportsman who was very famous, and he was somehow he felt that I should, whenever if I am given out, if the referee or the umpire does not declare me out also, I will walk. Which is quite astonishing in today's world. This was maybe 10, 15 years ago, I think. And he was heavily criticized by his team members, by the captain, by the press, saying that person is crazy. That if you are, even if you are out, and you still, and you should not go, even if you're out, because the umpire is a human being, the referee makes mistakes, so we should take advantage of that. And this is, so the perception of everybody, there was hardly anybody who came up and could say that, well, this is wonderful that a person feels that he's playing as a fun, and he's playing for the spirit of the game. But not a single person. It was like as if he has done the biggest crime. So it just shows the intensity of anger that to achieve the goal, that you can be ruthless, you can do anything. So this is the contrast that we see in the Krishna's world, where when Krishna is so kind, so mercifully gives his, he actually takes everyone back to Godhead. And on the other hand, here in the external world, so we have a choice at all times where we would like to be. Yeah, and also Krishna exhibits this violence to attract people's hearts. Because there are people who have the tendency to to be attracted by violent acts. So they are also, but ultimately Krishna takes care of all of them, because if they are sincere, if they are devotees, then they will somehow come to his lotus feet. So basically Krishna is doing everything he can to take us back. He will, even to the extent that to those who are attracted by chivalry, by valor, by fighting spirit, Krishna will demonstrate these acts. And like many people who have been attracted to the Mahabharata and later on hearing from the wise souls, they actually understand the position of the individual personalities like Arjun and the Pandavas, and what is actually righteousness, what is dharma, what is Bhishma's position, etc. And through that, they actually develop great attraction. So that is their sincerity, and they have been attracted by these acts. Or let's say the story of Dhruv Maharaj, where, even though he was 5 years old, he walked out, and he was so upset. Of course, he was also royalty, and he had that Kshatriya spirit. And when he was criticized, or when he was humiliated by his stepmother, the mood he had as a 5-year-old was that he wanted to take revenge. But then see the transformation that takes place. That he eventually, when Narad Muni then tests him, and then he guides him to go to the forest and pray to Lord Narayan. And during the process of prayer, his entire personality changes. So as we saw in our present world, good people, if they succumb to anger or revenge, they completely transform into unrecognizable people. You see a complete transformation. And here we see a child, a five-year-old child, who transformed into a pure devotee, just because, though he started off with, as he said, seeking pieces of broken glass, but just because he was guided by the right person and he followed the process very diligently, praying to the Lord. And at the end of it, when even the Lord was willing to offer whatever he wanted, he only had love for his family and he didn't want anything material. So we can see the transformation there. Same way in the case of Mrigari the hunter. Mrigari was also a person who was prone to violent acts. You know, he had great sadistic pleasure in seeing the animals and birds being maimed. You know, maimed means their wings are cut or their legs are cut. Means they are injured and they're writhing in pain, but he would like to see their pain. Which is, in other words, he enjoyed seeing the animals and birds being tortured. From there, because he came in touch with Narad Muni, who else? A complete transformation in his life, to the extent that he was then, after he could see the truth, he was praying to even the ants, because he didn't want to, he was so conscious and sensitive to even an ant moving on the ground. Even Valmiki Muni, the great author who wrote Ramayana, his beginnings also were like a dacoit, and he couldn't even pronounce the word Ram, but because he was, in all sincerity, because he was such a violent person, he used to speak the word Mara, to kill. So, but because he kept on saying, Mara, 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 so Mara became Ram. And because he was sincerely following it under the guidance of spiritual pure devotees, he completely transformed his life, and then he became one of the great sages. So the choice is ours as to whether we succumb to one or the other, but we also have great encouraging signs that we see that how devotees can, even in our own present day and age, can completely transform themselves into great personalities. So all these pastimes are for our purification, and that is actually the greatest need. So when we hear about Trinavarta and the hideous and very frightening description of how he became such a whirlwind, and Aputna and Agasur, and so many of the demons, and we see little Krishna. We see on one stage, the first, if you try to imagine what the situation would have must be in at that time. Because in this verse, we're talking about the emotions of the Brijvasis. The emotions shown that they were so happy when Krishna landed from something like... He had gone to tens of thousands of feet, probably hundreds of miles into the air, and when the demon comes crashing down, one would have expected that he would have fallen off the chest. But as Prabhupada said, that his chest was so broad that it was like a playground. Nothing happened to him. But then the emotions of the Brijvasis were so different. So that's something which is also an eye-opener for us. Because, see, the Brijvasis, as we have heard constantly, that because of their sheer purity and sincerity of their love for Krishna, total transparency of surrender, they cannot actually see the absolute position of the Lord. That is Yogmaya in action, that their concern is primarily and predominantly as per their paternal or friendly relations. For instance, Mother Yashoda is constantly thinking that if how I should bring this little naughty Krishna up as he should become a good gentleman, a good boy, and whatever I can do, I'll have to punish him to improve his behavior. That is her absorption to in her love for her child. She's willing to sacrifice anything. Even if he's away for even a moment, she can't bear it. Similarly, Nand Maharaj, he's also constantly thinking that how Krishna, my little child, can be a strong person. I must work hard so that I can give him grains and curd and so on, so that he becomes a very he'd be a strong person. He can protect all the cows and the others. So this, his absorption is again as a father, would, you know, just with pure love, unmotivated. And the gopis also had the same feeling. The older gopis would feel that somehow they couldn't understand why, though they had children, that their love was for him. They couldn't understand why the attraction and love for Krishna was much, much more than the attraction for their own children. They just accepted it, that is the way it is. And the younger gopis were not married. They just hankered for the sheer beauty of Krishna. They were willing to surrender everything. They wanted to just do anything to be at his lotus feet. So all of them, I mean, whoever was present there, were absorbed in that mood. So if you see that mood of love, and then if you were to see what kind of anxiety they must have gone through. Because you see, our love and attachment, if you compare what love and attachment we have, you know, we may be having for our family, and if somebody dies or somebody has a major illness or serious problem, I mean, it is, we feel devastated. We all know what it is like. But in Krishna's case, because it is not based on a temporary bodily relation which is only of one particular momentary lifetime, among millions of lifetimes, there's an eternal relationship that all these associates have. You can imagine what kind of anxiety they go through. The anxiety is incomparable, unimaginable, and therefore, from that incomparable anxiety, to see their happiness when they see him unhurt, it was Krishna's way of almost every time before lunchtime, almost every day, there would be one demon or the other would come up there, and it looked impossible because it was such a small child and such massive demons. But it was entirely done to enhance the love of the Lord, of the associates around him. So this, we cannot understand this emotion of transcendental anxiety because we are not on the pure platform. So as we talked of love and attachment, we cannot compare. Same way, our anxiety or our unhappiness has a certain level, because ultimately we said time is the best healer. We forget. We may have a very close person who may have died 15, 20 years ago. How often do we think now? And even if we on and off think, it is not something which devastates us moment to moment. It cannot be. It's just impossible. And so over time we forget. So that is gradually the way memory takes over, time takes its toll. But this is not the case here when we know how the gopis used to lament so bitterly that why they were lamenting to about thinking about Lord Brahma, that why has he created such a way, why has he created the eyes that need to blink? Why? Because just by blinking the eyes, even for a moment of a fraction of a moment, they were not able to see Krishna. So if that was the intense attraction and love for Krishna, you can imagine what must be the anxiety which must be caused in their hearts when he was not there. And we also, and to make us understand what this what is a spiritual emotion, we have the original guru Balram. Now he's amazing because he's there in most of the, he's always there in these pastimes. He himself also kills some of the demons, but most of the demons when Krishna kills, Balram is there as a young older brother, as a young boy, and he's always smiling. He's cool and relaxed. So one would say, why is there complete, you know, contrast? But actually, because Lord Balaram understands the nature of the spiritual emotions. He understands that these spiritual emotions have nothing to do with material emotions. They're completely different. See, the material emotions are like lust, fear, anger, greed, separation. All these are actually, they bind us more, and they are causes of misery, sorrow, and bondage. But if we direct that, if we direct this towards Krishna, then they completely transform itself into bliss, spiritual bliss. And so therefore, he understands this, that actually, though from an external point of view, as we read, whenever Krishna is in so-called distress, you know, when say Kaliya had caught him in his coils, or they walked into Agasur's mouth, we could see the gopas, gopis, his parents and others were in complete anxiety. But actually this anxiety was actually transcendental bliss, because they were on a spiritual platform. And this is not understandable to us, because of if we are not on the spiritual platform, if we are not on the pure devotee level. And this is what Balaramji understands, and therefore he is quite relaxed, because he knows that actually there it's another form of their bliss, of their transcendental ecstasy of being so close to each other that we cannot perceive it from the outside. So clearly appearances are deceptive. There is a very nice story once in New Vrindavan, and Prabhupada was there. One devotee asked him that, Prabhupada, you know, when we go out for book distribution, we are often told by the customers, you know, people who take the books, and they say, they look, go through it and they say, your Krishna consciousness, you keep telling us, is supposed to be full of bliss. But when we look at your guru, he's so grave, he's so sad, he sometimes looks angry, you know, he's very stern. So why is it so? So Prabhupada's reply was that you do not understand the science of transcendental ecstasy. So Prabhupada was in ecstasy. But so therefore we may judge from outside, we may judge we may see that how come they're lamenting and weeping, the gopis or the Mother Yashoda are lamenting and weeping. Like in the case of Madhavendra Puri, when he was about to depart from this world, and then Ramchandra Puri, was it? Who was completely, was critical of him, speaking you know, complete nonsense and criticizing him. And Madhavendra Puri, you know, admonishes him, saying that you get lost from here, because he couldn't understand, his cry was for separation. So we may create or commit offenses by trying to judge these emotions. Like in the case of, as Prabhupada said, that we cannot judge. You know, he is actually feeling that. He says, you cannot understand the science of transcendental ecstasy. In fact, Prabhupada often said that my purports, my books, are my transcendental ecstasies. Now, imagine if somebody sleeps only 2 hours, as we know, in his lifetime, in his 70s, and he gets up at 12 in the night, and then writes for 2, 3, 4 hours at a stretch. And if you've seen his pictures, you know, in the night, there's some most inspiring, hair-raising pictures. You see, there's complete darkness, and then see the photo of Prabhupada in his window on the second floor, back apartment. He's so very animatedly, you know, with his dictaphone in his hand. There's only a lamp light here. Everything is dark, and he's urgently doing it. If you see it, you see him so grave. And here Prabhupada is saying, these are my transcendental ecstasies. How can we judge? We cannot judge the happiness, the sheer bliss that he feels, which actually made him, what Krishna made him do this, what he's done, written transcendental literature, which will be the law books for the next 10,000 years. It's not possible. So we should at least, we can understand this from the scriptural point of view, and also try to avoid the negative, means the offensive mentality that could happen. On a lighter vein, just I remembered the, I was just reading about this, that one of our very good friends of our temple, who's now one of the most powerful businessmen in the country, he was actually narrating to us many years ago that he's a devotee. He was saying that he was taking his friends, 10 or 15 friends, to Goa. and the friends consisted of, you know, two or three chairmen of banks. There was a chairman of an insurance company and all these really big, big people. So they actually flew to Goa, and then on the return they decided, let's come by boat. So he had a very luxurious yacht, you know, absolutely state of the art and all that. So it was a beautiful one. So they started. On the first night itself, I think it was 1.5 days. So on the night, they all had, you know, their usual drinks and dinner, and you know, everyone was decked up so nicely, so feeling so comfortable and relaxed. They were in a very great mood. They had worn their best clothes, you know, everything. If you look at that, if somebody looks from the third world and sees from the, it says they're the happiest people, so gentle, so suave, so sophisticated. And this is, I'm giving his description. And then they went to sleep, and then in the night, it became very stormy. The sea was so stormy that actually the ship was, it was a small ship, a big yacht, was tossing from left to right in this. So it was not that it was going to capsize, but if you've not been on that, most of us have not, you know, we're not experiencing what it is. And Prabhupada talks about seasickness in such a huge cargo ship. So you can imagine, it's a different experience of what one feels. So the ship was tossing back and forth. And he says, you know, while some of the crew members were busy sleeping, because they were quite used to it, there was no problem. But he says, all of them came and they ran into the main hall. And he says, you should have seen them, because I had seen them 2 hours before. And then now when I see them, you know, one had forgotten his toupee, you know, his wig. It had come out. Another man, you know, all the mascara had come out. They were totally white in fear, and they were just gripping, and you know, they were like, you know, the facade had gone completely in 2 hours. He's saying that, and you know, he has a habit of laughing loudly. If he laughs, you know, he'll probably hear it in the next building, you know. So he was enjoying. He's saying, and he, of course, has been hearing the philosophy, so he understood that, you know, if you go by appearances, if you feel that, this is where we get trapped. I mean, oftentimes, you know, our desires or our goals are very much because we see people and our heroes, you know, when we see that you'd like to be like him, or we read about him and we see some photo of, you know, and then we see some very nice pictures of people who are always being seen happy. But we don't know that there is a public relations machine cranking out all these, you know, that where he goes, where this person goes, where he's seen, who is to be, everything is all planned. If you're willing to spend crores, you can create an image. You know, you have the nicest smiles, and every time they look very blissful. Have you ever seen the president or prime minister of any country in a very morose state? Never. You'll see them, you know, in the picture. It'll be the way they want us to see them. It has to be. So whoever successful, that's the way they do it. One of the biggest industries is aesthetic dentistry. Means dentist. We go to the dentist generally if you have a pain, or if you remove a tooth or fill the cavities. But aesthetic dentistry is just so that your smile looks better, your teeth are whiter, if there are some gaps in the teeth, they'll bring it. So it is cosmetic, and it is very expensive. It's in lakhs of rupees, but people go through it, especially those whose occupations very much demand it. So one can see that it's so critical for them, that, you know, how people perceive. And here we see, but it's a stressful thing. Actually, I think we all know that if we try to be what we are not, it's a very great stress. So we can't. So therefore, we go by the eyes of the Shastra, and we see that, leave aside the appearances, go for what we are. Rupa Goswami, for instance, Upadesha Amrit also says that he warns us that actually we should not judge people by their appearances. It was Prabhupada, or Prabhupada's godbrother, I'm not sure, who also said that when I first heard that we should never, we should not ask, go into the details of the pure devotee's childhood pastime before he has manifested his divine mission or his final pastimes. Why? Because people will not understand it. People will just go and say, oh, he's so mundane, he's also like, blood, pus, urine, you know, he's also saying, what, you're talking of pure devotee. The whole mentality is very different. Therefore, we can understand from the eyes of the Shastra, but what to say, when to say, and how to say it, it is very different. So basically, to summarize the two broad approaches, one, that the acts of violence that we see, so-called acts of violence of Krishna, are actually meant for our purification. And on the contrast is what we actually see here, which is actually the degradation of the soul, because it is on uncontrolled senses. And then the happiness and the emotions that we see in the verse, they're so happy. We cannot understand the spiritual emotions of happiness or anxiety because we're not on that level. We can feel it somewhat, but we are not on that level. But one thing suffices to say, that Krishna, whatever he does, whatever situation he creates for anyone eternally, is always to enhance our love for him, our remembrance for him, so that we can come back to him. The only thing is, if we don't, so when tragedies or difficulties come, it is also meant for that. But if we are not trained to look at it that way, if we don't hear the Shastras, don't read about it, or don't follow instructions, then we are prone to become hateful, bitter, and we'll act on that basis. On the other hand, if we are following the path, then we understand that whatever the situations come, we have that full faith that Krishna creates the situation for our benefit. It is basically to increase our approach towards him, and therefore we should be grateful at all times, whatever the situation. I often quote this, that, you know, we generally, the tendency is when we say that if something wonderful happens, somebody gets a lottery, somebody gets a big business deal, somebody gets a new house and whatever, we say, oh, God is very kind. God is kind at all the times. I mean, even if nobody says this when there are difficulties, nobody says God is great. That time we don't say it. So actually we tend to feel that actually if some good thing happens, then God is great. But by implication we are saying that if something difficult is there, then God is not so great. Actually Krishna is always merciful. And if we see that, if we see it in from that light, and if we believe in it, then really we are actually in a much, much better frame of mind to calmly and peacefully, you know, follow Krishna conscious instructions. So I'll end here. Hare Krishna. Are there any questions? Maybe we have time for one. So, Mike.
Hare Krishna.
Yes, bro.
I just want to ask us one small question, is that we always talk about suffering. So what is suffering actually, the body or the soul?
Actually, because the soul identifies, the soul is not suffering, soul is always in bliss. But the living entity is identifying himself or herself with the body, and that is why we go through these material emotions of, as I said, lamentation, fear, anger, hatred, suffering. But as we withdraw from that and we see it from Krishna's point of view and we come closer to Krishna, then the suffering disappears. So the same act, for instance, Prahlad Maharaj, you can say Prahlad Maharaj came in Satyayug. Let's say he was a child who had a very powerful father, and the father was trying to kill him. Now that situation can be even in today's world. We read about it that there are fathers who try to kill their children. So there's no difference. But what was the difference? The Prahlad Maharaj was, because he was a pure devotee, he was completely blissful and happy because he had complete faith in the Lord. So the external circumstances were same that time and now. But in Prahlad Maharaj's case, so that is really our consciousness dictates our suffering. And that is what we mean by Krishna consciousness. That anything we do, if we try to bring our consciousness to the fact that Krishna is the proprietor of everything, we are his children, and he wants us to come back to him, and we want to find out how we can go back to him via the medium of spiritual master. And if we try to dedicate our life, then what we see, the so-called suffering, somebody, you know, our health gives way, our finances give way, our somebody's close relative leaves this world, whatever, we will actually see it in a different light, just like we read in the Shastras. So it's basically our the suffering is our identification with the body and the bodily emotions. But if we transform it, then we will cease to see suffering. Like in Prabhupada's case, you see his life. I mean, one we can say, my God, what tragedies. But he never saw it. He was only fixed on one thing, and he was very blissful. We discussed with almost the whole class about he was feeling ecstatic when externally one would think that he should be very sad because, okay, he went to the US, he had no money. Wouldn't that be a cause of anxiety? I mean, you'd be no money in a foreign land, and that too 50 years ago, 40 years ago. You know, right now it may be easier because you have some relatives or friends or something. That time it was a very different world, and he'd never been there. He was never in anxiety. For that 1 year also, he was sitting under that Tompkins Square Park garden, under the tree, chanting, and just his only focus. Yes, he had transcendental anxieties. His anxieties were how I can please my spiritual master, how I can follow the instruction. That was all. When he was approaching the Boston Harbor, after going through two heart attacks and all these seasicknesses, a person who at 70 years old, when he's approaching, his anxiety would be, I hope somebody's come to receive me. I hope somebody, where am I going to go? Where am I going to stay? His only thing, he was praying that to the Lord that, I am your puppet, make me dance as you wish. And then this 1 year he had no contact. He didn't know anyone. And he just left it to Krishna, and gradually some Michael Grant comes here and so-and-so comes in, and gradually somebody gives him a room, he starts chanting. He was not worried, where am I going to get my next meal? So basically from an external point of view, you'd say he was suffering, he was anxious, but he was not. He was in total bliss. So that gives us great sustenance, you know, great hope, great encouragement. This is real life, this is reality. So in our case, why should we, when we look at our suffering, they're so puny, but we make it so big. Have I answered your question? Any other questions? So Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.